This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 22nd of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 80th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Hooray for the random, we say, as we plunge headlong into a show that's all over the place in a good way, haywire in a handsome way, all-encompassing in a Catholic tastes kind of style. So what are we up to? Oh, you know, not much, just going to Paris, his wonderful Fondation Cartier, to see the new show from British sculptor Ron Mueck.
Sources for Ron Mueck are coming from the street, from day-by-day life, but can come from art history, from press images, from very different things.
Oh yeah, and guess who's back? We'll be looking at the return of South Korea's soft power monster, Psy, and assess how you make big money from all those millions of YouTube hits. And we'll welcome Murray Lachlan Young, a king amongst poets, to share with us some rhyme and unreason.
The vibe was contagious, his entrance outrageous. To breathe in the air became disadvantageous. So with the tss, tss, tss of his special fragrance, into the room busted Sean Diddy Combs onto Raj, very large for a bling bling player.
Oh, and we'll also welcome one of the brightest, best and biggest new stars in the US country scene, Kacey Musgraves. How wonderful she is. Also, a couple more art hits. We'll ask, when is a gallery not a gallery? And we'll drop in on Art Brussels. That's all here on Culture, with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. And regular listeners will find no horse-scaring surprises right here at the top of the show. We start with a song by the wondrous Kacey Musgraves, fresh from Nashville, with a suite of songs climbing all over the US charts and dropping by Midori House last week for a session. From it, here is Kacey Musgraves with Follow Your Arrow.
If you save yourself from marriage, you're a bore. If you don't save yourself from marriage, you're a horrible person. If you won't have a drink, then you're a prude. But they'll call you a drunk as soon as you down the first one. If you can't lose the weight, then you're just fat. But if you lose too much, then you're on crack. You're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. So you might as well just do whatever you want. So make lots of noise, kiss lots of boys, or kiss lots of girls if that's something you're into. When the straight and narrow gets a little too straight, roll up a joint, or don't. Just follow. You'll go to hell. If you're the first one on the front row, you're a self-righteous son of a can't win for losing. You'll just disappoint them. Just cause you can't beat them don't mean you should join them. Make lots of noise, kiss lots of boys, or kiss lots of girls if that's something you're into. In a straight it's a little too straight, roll up a joint, or don't, just follow your arrow wherever it points, yeah, follow your arrow wherever it points. Say what you think, love who you love, cause you just get so many trips round the sun, yeah, you only, only lots of boys, or kiss lots of girls, if that's what you're into. When a straight and narrow gets a little too straight, roll up a joint, I would, and follow your arrow wherever it points, yeah, follow your arrow wherever.
That was Casey Musgrave singing Follow Your Arrow for us here at Midori House last week. And true to form, we'll have more from Casey later on in the show. Well, in a moment, we'll be asking how you can monetize a YouTube hit. We're thinking Psy here, by the way. But first here on Culture, we're hopping on the Eurostar to Paris on a beautiful spring day to visit the new show by the Australian-born British sculptor Ron Muick at the lovely, glassy Fondation Cartier. You'll know Muick's work perhaps from his hyper-realistic, normally human sculptures. His dead dad work was included in the seminal sensation show way back when at the Royal Academy. You might know his supersized self-portrait mask too. The Fondation Cartier are showing three new works amongst a slim but satisfying survey show of nine. These works are all about the frailty of thin skin, the sort of weirdness of human hair, much messing around with scale and certainty, a sense of how the superordinary becomes surreal with study, and there's some vulnerability and beauty and tenderness too. I spoke to the show's curator, Grazia Quaroni.
There is something which seems very hyper-realistic in the sculpture of Ron Muick. He is extremely skillful in making skins and all details of human body. But then we suddenly realize that hyper-realism is not a good term to describe these sculptures because they give no indication to the visitor on who these persons are and what is their story, where they are and in which time. So the idea is more to give archetypals of human beings and show something that belongs not to an individuality but to a common culture that reflects different moments of our life every time.
There's a sort of universal thing, there's a kind of slice of life idea to some of these sculptures. But also, we were talking about some of the works downstairs, and you're talking about biblical and classical allusion as well. The wounds of Christ that he asks Thomas to touch, and a man on a lilo who looks like a sort of third-rate Jack Nicholson with limbs that are slightly too long, like a crucifixion scene. So there's lots of different influences seem to run into Ron Muick's work.
I wouldn't talk of influences, but more of sources. Sources for Ron Muick are coming from the street, from day-by-day life, but can come from art history, from press images, from very different things. And some of them have been encouraged or informed probably by visions of or dreams. And visions and dreams and imaginations are part of reality, exactly like day-by-day life. So also the sculptures that belong to another dimension and that seem so far away from reality, they are actually a part of reality, which is something we all experimented, and so we can all confirm that these visions exist.
I want to ask you about a couple of works specifically. There are two female forms in this room at the Fondation Cartier. One is a new work, which is Woman with Shopping Bags. She looks exceptionally realistic. She's kind of got dirty hair. She's got a baby clinging to her, sort of inside her overcoat, and she's got two very full Sainsbury's shopping bags. All of this is handmade by Ron Muick, isn't it?
All of this is handmade by Ron Muick. Actually, the work in the studio is extremely important for him, and it's certainly what he likes best. So all details are made in the studio by the artist who works with very few assistants in a tiny, small studio. That's his choice. Although maternity is a very common scene that we can see in art history all over the times, this is a particular one. The mother looks exhausted, actually, and the baby is missing her glance. And so there is sort of something about the first frustration of the humans and of the weight of life, of everyday life. There's nothing tragic, nothing dramatic, but it's a point of view which is not appealing at all, and so it's never seen before, and it gives a real humanity to this culture.
And obviously Ron Mueck's work is exceptionally detailed. That's maybe one of the most famous things about his work, is this lifelike quality. And we mentioned the Dutch masters in Flemish painting, famous obviously for their detail as well. But this is very, there's a lot more vulnerability in this than there is in still lives or amazingly lifelike sort of Dutch portraiture of the 18th century, isn't there? There's a lot of the thinness of skin, there's a lot of vulnerability perhaps.
Absolutely. There is always a sort of delicacy somehow. There is a tenderness. And this vulnerability comes from the attention that he puts in the care, he puts in the observation of human beings, of human details. And I think that it is really related to the attitude he has toward humans in general, you know. So it's strictly linked to the way he is. And that's why it's so easy for the public to get into a sort of compassion with all sculptures and share a real moment. So that's why the experience of being with the sculpture is extremely important.
That was Grazia Quaroni speaking to me at the Fondation Cartier in Paris. And if you're in the city, you can see the Ron Mueck exhibition there until the 29th of September. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're headed east now to soak up a bit of pop culture. After smashing the record for most number of views ever on YouTube and subsequently securing what can best be described as world domination, it was easy to assume that South Korean superstar Psy might well have been banished to the one-hit wonder corner with his next release. Well, last week, the new video Gentleman hit our computer screens and secured 20 million hits in its first day alone. Pundits are now claiming this makes him a bigger deal than Justin Bieber. World, take note. Musical integrity aside, producer Katie wanted to talk business. So she called up Bernie Cho, president of the Seoul-based K-pop agency DFSB Collective, to ask how you make money from a YouTube phenomenon and find out whether or not he thinks Psy's new offering is actually any good.
Psy has always put out really quirky, funny hit songs, and I think this really doesn't sort of, you know, break the mold or you know, is out of step with what he's accustomed to doing. I mean, obviously, it was going to be so hard to match up the Gangnam Style. I mean, how do you break 1.5 million views? I think it's really funny that instead of, why try to break that record, just set a new record instead, which obviously did, which is a speed record. I think the song itself is good, and I think the music video is probably as good as Gangnam Style, and given how massive that hit was, I think good is actually good enough.
How important do you think the kind of shock factor is for him? Because the song's called Gentleman, obviously a bit of an ironic title because he's kind of misbehaving in the video. I could give you a whole list of examples, you know, pushing a girl off a running machine, reaching into his pants and putting the contents of what he finds there in a girl's face, undoing someone's bikini top, pushing someone over in a restaurant. It's quite juvenile behavior, isn't it?
It is juvenile humor, no doubt about it, but the fact that you're talking about it and I'm talking about it means that we've probably seen the video at least a few dozen times to analyze, and in many cases, no pun intended, maybe perhaps psychoanalyze what the video is all about.
Do you think he's trying to tap into a young audience with something like that?
Well, I think he's already captured that young audience. I mean, when you looked at Gangnam Style and you looked at the viral videos, you had everybody from grandmothers to babies figuring out and doing that dance. Thankfully, his new dance, I think, is a lot easier on the hips and on the joints. But, you know, his appeal in Korea, and I think obviously now outside of Korea, is very much all ages. Everyone talks about he could have been, should have been a one-hit wonder, but now that he's got a second hit on his hands, I mean, as far as I know, I've never heard of the term two-hit wonder yet. So, we'll see.
I mean, the figures are really impressive, and a lot of people are saying now that YouTube is probably the world's most important outlet for music videos, if not the internet's most important outlet for music videos. But talking from the perspective of someone in the music industry, can you monetize that kind of success? I mean, 142 million people have seen this video, but does that mean it's actually making him any money?
Very much so. I mean, I think what's really brilliant about Psy, but more importantly, his management company here at Korea YG Entertainment, was very early on, they embraced YouTube not only for the promotional value, but for the commercial opportunities. It was reported that just on the YouTube views alone, the ad revenue profit that he made from Gangnam Style when it just passed $1 billion was roughly $4 million. And then the fact that he became so big because of that video, you know, it reeled him in about $5 million in commercial endorsements. And again, watching that video and then linking it through to iTunes, just the sales alone on what he did on Gangnam Style in the U.S. was about $2.6 million. So to answer the question, yes, you can, and he definitely has monetized the busyness of YouTube into a full-blown business.
And are there certain brands that we see or you see who are kind of desperate to get in on that or are dominating the kind of advertising market on YouTube?
Well, I think what's really interesting is that, you know, on one hand, a lot of people have been looking at sort of size, you know, juvenile antics in that music video. But there have been others here in Korea who've been looking at the product placement, actually, in the video for Gentlemen. For instance, in the beginning of the video, you see the Candy Crush Saga mobile game. That's a huge thing here in Korea. And although it's rumored and the label has disputed the rumor, but, you know, the rumor being is that they paid $1 million for that three-second placement. And if that's true, that would make his video more expensive than a Super Bowl ad. I don't think it's particularly true, but definitely there's some product placement involved. What definitely is probably a little bit more verifiable is, you know, in one of the scenes, there's a AA paper planted all over the copy machines in one of those music video scenes. That's not there by coincidence because Psy also happens to be a model for that particular brand. During the sort of drinking scenes in the outdoor little kind of restaurant, it's no coincidence that the soju he's drinking, Chamisu, Psy's a model for that soju. And if you look next to the soju, there's a can of beer from Height. He also happens to be a model for that brand. So Psy is not only making money from the advertising that appears at the beginning and end and during his music videos, his music video itself is almost a moving ad in and of itself.
That was Bernie Cho, president of the Seoul-based K-pop agency DFSB Collective, talking to producer Katie Bilboa there. And don't try and pretend you haven't watched that yet. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. After this short break, you will hear the best, if perhaps only, poem about P. Diddy you've ever heard. Go nowhere.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're going to deviate into the slightly unknown magical forest of nonsense poetry with a wonderful poet who used to be known as a performance poet, but that seems a little silly to me. Anyway, he is Murray Lachlan Young, and he's a bit of a genius with words spoken and writ, and he's preparing for the Hendrix Carnival of Knowledge in Brighton next month. Here he is.
Well, it's interesting because I was just thinking about the reinvention of nonsense, and before I came on, I mean, I guess you could say it goes all the way back to Anglo-Saxon times. I don't know.
That's because no one can understand it. It just is literally nonsense.
In translation, yeah. Maybe it's more to do with the translation. Yeah, yeah. But so they had the period when they were writing Lewis Carroll, and we all know Alice in Wonderland or Alice Through the Looking Glass. That is kind of crazy.
Yeah, and is that nonsense or is it? Yeah.
Opium-based. People say there's potentially a lot of drug-based issues going on around nonsense poetry. And then the revival, of course, came with the psychedelic movement in the 60s and 70s. So John Lennon was a nonsense writer. And then if you look at Yellow Submarine, completely nonsense. And that was all around psychedelic drugs. So I don't know, are we waiting for the right drug?
So we're always waiting for the right drug.
Welcome to Monocle
24, where we're always waiting for the right drug.
Maybe the right drug is the fact that people aren't, that taking drugs isn't really cool anymore. The brain is the drug of choice, I think.
Yeah.
If it's pulling words together. And the exciting thing about nonsense poetry is that you're just allowed to pull words together. So I think for poetry or for any sort of production of words, essentially all you're doing is joining words together. And nonsense poetry gives you this kind of completely out there ability to pull any words together and just see what they sound like.
Can you give our listeners an example of something that has a very rhythmic quality? Something that not they can
mine.
Yeah, sure. Not that they can click their fingers to, but they can swoon along to.
Maybe. Yeah. So I've got a poem about P. Diddy. He came to a nightclub in London, and he had a huge entourage with him. And in the entourage, he had two guys who were specifically tasked to spray his own brand perfume every 10 minutes in the room. He also had his own drinks brand with him. And they all came in, completely overtook this place and filled it full of the eau de Diddy. And the idea is that this is the poem, which I wasn't there, but if I was there, maybe this is what I would have written. So it's called, I can't remember what it's called actually, but it goes.
Eau de Diddy is a great name for it.
Eau de Diddy, let's call it Eau de Diddy. Okay, Eau de Diddy. The vibe was contagious, his entrance outrageous. To breathe in the air became disadvantageous. So with the tss, tss, tss of his special fragrance, sprayed by his very special fragrance sprayer, into the room busted Sean Diddy combs onto Raj very large for a bling bling player. A bling bling player, yeah, yeah, a bling bling player, and all the ladies are when a crazy are with the boom, 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 a boom, boom, with the boom, 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 a boom, boom, and the fellas, they put their hands up with a zoom, 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 a zoom, zoom, with the zoom, 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 a zoom, zoom, and did he give a little love? Did he? And did he bust a little move? Did he? And did he give a little love? And did he bust a little move? And did he drink a little vodka in a did a little bootin' with a tss 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 and the sub bass boom? Did the room smell the plume of the did it comb? Did it comb? Yeah, yeah. Did it comb? A did it comb with a boomalaka boomalaka boom 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 with the boomalaka boomalaka boom boom boom. And somebody shouted out, no way, man, like this shit is obscene. And somebody else shouted out, chillax, blood. It's just like a middle-aged brother, man, like giving it a big one, living out the dream. And with the DJ gagging because the smell was so strong, somebody shouted out, hey, Diddy, you're the Diddy man. But the Diddy was gone to who knows where, but I guess it was a place containing crystal, champagne, hot booty, and bass. Bitches in the living room getting it on. I ain't going home till 6 in the morning, because that's what happened when you walk in the room. That's what happened when you're busted by the plume, and that's what happened when you're drenched in the fume. When you're drenched in the fume of the diddy-diddy comb with the diddy-diddy comb. Yeah, yeah. Diddy-diddy comb with the a diddy-diddy comb with the boomalaka boomalaka boom 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 with the boomalaka boomalaka boom 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 with a tss a tss a boom boom.
That is Murray Loughlin Young performing. They're clapping from behind the glass. That was brilliant.
That's kind of
Ode rhythm.
That's rhythm.
Ode of the Day was called Ode of the Day. Ode of the Day.
Ode of the Day. Thank you for
Ode
helping me name
it. Exactly. Ode of the Day. And I wanted to go, Murray, so that to fill our listeners in, I wanted to go way back. It seemed like in the late 90s or early noughties, there was a great push for poetry and you signed a huge deal.
I mean, it was one of those things where it just got lucky. So it was a great story. It had a great couple of photographs that went with it. There was nothing else going on in the world, you know, at that particular time. None of the stuff had happened. The Twin Towers hadn't gone down. You know, none of those things were happening. And there seemed to be a lot less earthquakes around in those days as well. And there just happened to be this hole, and it was the Murray Loughlin Young-shaped hole, which suddenly was filled by Murray Loughlin Young. And then, like any story, a story has to maintain its motor, and you can only have He's the Million Pound Poet. It will only last for a certain amount of time before you need something else to go with it. And then it became... And he's shit as well.
Yeah, obviously. Obviously everyone's going to say that.
And there's lots and lots of really good poets out there, and he's stolen all the money from them.
Oh, God.
But it was this huge festival of jealousy suddenly came up around it. And
it was a great idea for a festival, that is.
For the festival.
Headlining the Festival of Jealousy. It's Murray Loughlin Young.
Well, the worst, the most bizarre thing was that I started getting, you know, all the stuff that you get with suddenly becoming like you're Warholianly famous.
Yeah.
And there I was on all these front pages. And of course, you then attract all these people who there's some groups of them are, you know, at the end of train station platforms, and the other end of them waiting outside the BBC for famous people. And then you get the higher grade, who are the ones who actually start stalking you.
Nice.
And so they're suddenly going from being just having a great time in London to having sort of stalkers and paparazzi and all this sort of weird stuff going on.
But it is weird suddenly to be at the centre of a maelstrom, presumably. Was that kind of a balm to your creative juices? Did that
No, it wasn't at all. That was really kind of the sad thing about it all, was that there was a terrible feeling crept into me at the time that I actually wasn't good enough, and that they were right, and that I was actually shit, and my work was really rubbish, and it didn't work on the page, and la 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 la. And I started to become really, really anxious, and then drank a lot at the same time. And it just, this terrible feeling of being a complete imposter consumed me. And I felt like I'd kind of let everybody down. And I think the problem is, of course, for many people who find themselves in that situation, who don't really know who they are, they're having a go at something, and then suddenly everyone says, "So it's you." And you're like, "Yes, it's me." And they say, "Well, what does it mean?" And it doesn't have to mean anything, of course. But kids, you know, people, you know, 27-year-old men, I considered myself a kid, really still at that age, didn't really have any clue. And to be exposed to that level of media on a daily basis is very corrosive. And for me, it was all too much. And the creative work just stopped completely, to the point where I couldn't actually perform or write or anything for about three or four years. And then Mark Rylance from the Shakespeare's Globe called me up and said, "Would you write something for Shakespeare's Globe?" And I was like, "But I'm shit." And he was like, no, you're really good." And so I just about hauled myself.
That's a nice call to take.
Yeah, I mean, but I still didn't believe him even. I just thought he was just silly, because he does come across quite mad.
Yes, he's
And I
quite,
just thought
yeah.
he's just obviously mad, and I'll do it anyway, you know.
We're going back to nonsense, Murray.
Great.
Down in Brighton, we're dipping our toes. I don't know what temperature the water is, but we're going to dip our toes into the fast-running waters of nonsense.
Yeah, well, in Brighton, I'm really excited about it, because my friends at the Idler have commissioned me, and I've had a few commissions from them before, to write a nonsense poem. And it's something that I think I'm probably the same as most people around nonsense poetry, is that I kind of know what it is, but I don't really understand it. So what I've got now is a commission where I can go away, read a bunch of nonsense poetry, work out what I think it is, then come up with a nonsense poem, then go to Brighton to the Hendrix event at the Carnival of Knowledge, and then I deliver the poem, and then the fabulous Claire Pollard explains and explores nonsense poetry with the audience, and then they get to talk. If they've got any nonsensical thoughts themselves, they can put them to her, and she can bring those into the great sphere of nonsense poetry. So
I like that. So she's sort of shining her torch into the murky wood of nonsense.
Yeah, it's like I went to a shop the other day, and this woman had a card, and it said "denim specialist." I've never been to a store which has got a denim specialist. She's a nonsense specialist. So having writing a nonsense poem, and then I'm giving it to the nonsense specialist, and she's going to put it in context.
She's going to sort of wear a white coat or something.
Well, yeah.
Stethoscope round her neck.
A sort of a nonsense academician.
That was mighty Murray Lachlan Young talking to me there. And if you're in the UK, he'll be performing at Hendrix Carnival of Knowledge during the Brighton Fringe on the 25th of May. Don't you think he's welcome in any time for a chat? Still to come in part two, we'll enjoy some more of that great Midori House session from the frankly wasted on the radio Casey Musgraves. We'll ask how Middle Eastern art has gone down at Art Brussels, and we'll ask when a gallery isn't a gallery and whether bricks and mortar still matter. Top notch. So first, some more from that glorious Midori House session all the way from Nashville. Here's Casey Musgraves with Silver Lining.
Woke up on the wrong side of rock bottom. You're all out of pennies and the well it done run dry. You'd light them up and smoke them if you had them, but you just ain't got them. Ain't we always looking for a bluer sky. If you're ever gonna find a silver lining, it's gotta be a cloudy day. It's gotta be a cloudy day. If you wanna fill your bottle up with lightning, you're gonna have to stand in the rain. Yeah, you're gonna have to stand in the rain. Say you're just unlucky, but luck ain't what you need. Cause if you're ever gonna find a four-leaf clover, you gotta get a little dirt on your hands. You gotta get a little dirt on your hands. And if you wanna find a head that fits your shoulder, you're gonna have to go to the dance. Yeah, you're gonna have to go to the dance.
All right, y'all.
And if you wanna find the honey, you can't be scared of the bees. Yeah. And if you wanna see the forest, you're gonna have to look past the trees.
Casey Musgrave, thank you so much for your Midori House session.
Thank you.
And you spoilt us, really, because that was basically a gig. You did a gig for us. Normally we get a few tracks, and that was a proper thing. The album is called Same Trailer, Different Park. Is this for your core audience, or is this a nice kind of joke in the title?
Both. It could probably mean several different things, but it came from a line in Merry Go Round where it says, same hurt in every heart, same trailer, different park. I just kind of liked it because it, to me, meant we're kind of all the same. Yeah, and then there's a bit of jest also because I did at one time live in a trailer, so.
But now you're based in Nashville.
Yes, yep.
The album sounds like it was made in Nashville.
Yes.
What's it like moving there? What does the kind of weight of history bear down upon you? Obviously so many legends, especially in kind of country music or country-tinged music from there. What's that feel like to walk into a studio with all that history?
It's insane. The place that I recorded my record at is the old RCA studio.
Right.
And, you know, it was owned by Chet Atkins at one point, and like Loretta, Dolly, Elvis, I mean, everybody recorded there, and it's got such a good vibe. It's got good mojo in it. So I love older spaces like that.
And does walking into a place like that and cutting your record in a place like that, does it kind of infect the record? Does anything change because of that building, because of that thing? Or did you have a very clear set of songs down already?
We had a pretty clear vision, but maybe it felt so good, and you know, it influenced in ways maybe we're not aware of. I just wanted to pick somewhere like that as opposed to like a bright, shiny, brand new, crisp studio. You know, I like to have a little bit of grunge in it. And
you need a little grit to make the oyster, don't you?
Exactly. Yeah.
You mentioned the track Merry-Go-Round. It's the last track you played for us on the session. That was been a big single. I think it started getting big airplay in September back out in the US, back home in the US. What does that feel like when suddenly, you know, lots of great things have been said about you, but you're still a prodigious talent. What happens when you start hearing this stuff on the radio and cars are stopped at traffic lights and you're listening to your song coming out of the radio? That's a strange feeling.
It is strange. I honestly haven't heard it all that much on the radio, but I remember the first time I did hear it and I like freaked out. And you know, I've been kind of like preparing myself for that moment for a while, because obviously that's the goal, you know, with putting music out, but I didn't know how hard it would hit me. And my sister was in the car with me and we were just riding around Nashville and it came on and I just, like, tears just started pouring out. And I mean, the second time I heard it, I didn't.
We talked about live. How does that work when you, I mean, I know you've been performing live. I mean, most people cut their teeth kind of doing all sorts of small gigs around the country and stuff, or around where they're from. That was, I guess, how you started out. How does it change when the gigs and the venues get bigger? Do you have to kind of change the songs you do, or do you have to beef up the production, have more instruments? How does it work?
Well, my goal, like this summer, I'm on a stadium tour in arenas with Kenny Chesney. It's weird because I feel like I could just sit in this room with you and just play my guitar and get my songs across, you know, the point. Uh-huh. So I don't know. It's hard because you have to now reach the person in the nosebleed section and who paid for their ticket and wants to see the show. But I just want to try to like figure out how to take what I do and not make it cheesy, but just maybe make it a little bigger.
Like, so you're going to fire yourself out of a cannon and stuff like that?
Yeah, I'm going to wear something flaming.
Perfect.
Or,
That's exactly, that's the kind
something
of subtle thing.
Yeah,
perfect. That's good. Did different fans come along from the UK, say, than your average American fan?
I would say there was a pretty huge mix of people, pretty diverse at the show last night. We had old, young, lots of girls, a few guys, one or two in cowboy hats. I'm like, where'd you come from?
I was going to ask you that question. I'm glad I didn't need to ask it. Some Stetsons are in the
There was
audience.
A couple.
Okay. Do like people ask them to behind them to take them off?
Or? No, I don't think so.
Because okay. that's quite
they
a
were
wide.
Pretty tall. Yeah.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I do like kind of that about coming over here and playing is that like it's not just squashed into one genre and boxed in. You know, it's just considered music, I feel like. And that's kind of my ultimate goal is just to make good music, you know, regardless of what it's called, I guess. So
maybe you can tell us what you grew up listening to. I mean, I guess that's why you use the instruments you use and the record sounds the way it does.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, it's a really eclectic mix. Like I grew up singing really traditional, like Western swing, Texas swing kind of stuff, really traditional country. But at the same time, I was like, you know, a seventh grader who loved like NSYNC and Spice Girls.
Yeah, precisely.
And, my dad played a lot of Tom Petty and stuff around the house. I love Dolly Parton. And I mean, I literally, it's if you looked at my iPod, it'd be like everything from Tupac to Buck Owens to, I mean, just the Beatles, everything.
That was Kacey Musgraves, whose album Same Trailer, Different Park is out now. And she'll be playing a series of dates across the US from 4th of May. Just visit kaceymusgraves.com. That's with a C to find out more. And you're tuned in right now to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Right, next up, we're headed from Nashville to Belgium, where the Art Brussels Art Fair has just wrapped up. The event featured 187 galleries from all over the world, totaling more than 2,000 artists. And one gallery who was showing their wares was Dubai-based Isabel van den Eynde. And you might see a link with the Brussels in her name. We wonder what it's like after the art world has descended on the UAE for Art Dubai to try and export work from that region to the buyers of Central Europe. So he dispatched Nelly Gotcheva to find out.
My name is Minnie and I work for Gallery Isabel van den Eynde in Dubai. We have a selection of artists who represent really the core of our gallery artists. So we have Rokhni and Ramin Harizadeh, who are two Iranian brothers. They live in Dubai. And we have Hassan Sharif, who is an Emirati artist. He's an older generation. He's one of the founding fathers of conceptual art in the Emirates, which is really quite a revolutionary time and experience for quite a conservative country. And then we have Bita Fayazi, who's also an Iranian artist. We have Zuleika Bouabdallah, who is an Algerian artist. And then we have Abdelkader Ben Shamma, who is also an Algerian artist.
Tell me, how important is Brussels for you and for your type of art and for your artists? Why are you here?
We're here partly because the gallery owner is actually Belgian. So obviously we've kept coming, and after a while you build relationships, but she obviously already had a network of people here. So it made our approach in the city easier. We find that there is a lot of interest in Europe for our artists. It's really growing, and we have to keep coming to these kinds of fairs to really establish a presence and people start to recognize the artists and watch their careers grow. So we definitely have a market here, interest, and it's nice to be able to continue showing artists so that people can engage with their careers.
So that was my next question, actually. How do you promote your artists, like artists from the Emirates in Europe or even internationally, if you go like globally across the pond and, you know, in the States or even Latin America?
Yeah. Firstly, obviously, art fairs. It's a really great way. We have different ones. We were just in Armory in New York, so that was quite a reach for us, obviously a long way from Dubai. And one of our artists who was with us in Armory and is here today at this fair, Rokhni Harizadeh, is now going to participate in the Carnegie International 2013. So that's really exciting for us and for him. And obviously it's ways like this that our artists make it onto a more global map.
And what about back home? How is the art scene in Dubai? What's happening there now?
A lot is happening. Art Dubai just happened in March, and that was a really great fair, like better than any other year. It's drawing a more international crowd to actually come to the city as well. It's not just a local scene. It's become really internationally acknowledged, and we just hope that it continues to grow and that people find the art accessible and interesting. It's a process.
My name is Katerina Gregos. I'm a curator and I'm the artistic director of Art Brussels, where we are right now. As you probably know, Art Brussels has quite a long history. This is the 31st edition. We have built up a reputation as an art fair that supports young talent and acts as a kind of barometer for contemporary art and emerging artists. The fair is separated into various sections. There is the main gallery section, which includes more established galleries. And then we have three very special sections. We have a section with the solo shows, which is dedicated to one-person presentation of artists, where one can see the work of an artist more in depth. We have the young talent section, which includes almost 60 galleries, and thus constitutes a large part of the fair. The fair is almost 190 galleries. And we have also the first call section, which includes galleries that support young artists that have never been present at Art Brussels before. So obviously for us, some of the highlights are the young talent and the first call.
Can you tell me more about this first-timers at this year's edition?
Well, I wanted to introduce a non-commercial parameter to the fair. Brussels is a city that has a lot of very important private but also not-for-profit institutions that are an integral part of the artistic landscape of the city. And as Art Brussels is, of course, a very strong force for Brussels, I also wanted to see how it's possible to develop links with the city of Brussels, which is right now undoubtedly Europe's most upcoming art city. More and more international galleries are moving here. Also, a lot of international artists are making Brussels their home. There's a lot of activity, and I wanted to see how the fair can actually connect to some of these initiatives and these institutions. And that is why I invited six of the most interesting Brussels-based spaces. I'd like to mention, for example, Établissement d'en Face, which is one of the oldest artist-run spaces, which has conceived a very interesting project where you arrive at a kind of old medieval style door and you have to press a button and go into the unknown. There is a more recent, a more new space called Avenue de Jette Institut du Carton, and they're doing a very conceptual project called Bureau des Titres. They're collecting potential art, potential titles for an exhibition that they're going to do in 2014.
Some sights and sounds there from the Art Brussels Art Fair, courtesy of Nelly Gotcheva. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. After break, we'll be discussing the definition of an art gallery. Just a light one, then.
From the historic centre of pencil making to the world's biggest trade fair, Monocle Films profiles a pioneering German stationery brand taking the pencil into the 21st century.
It is more or less in our genes to make pencils. And behind this is not only the region of Nuremberg, it's also the German type of engineering, of really digging deep into things, trying to understand things and to create novelties from this deep understanding of how things are made.
Sharpening Up with Stettler, in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're almost at the end of the show, but we just have time to philosophise a little. In 2011, a report was published that claimed that traditional gallery model is in decline. According to the organisation, new and alternative ways of selling art are changing the ways in which collectors are buying. It's a topic we've been following here on Culture, from the rise of the art fair to the emergence of various pop-up galleries and online platforms designed to showcase or commission art. So when our pal Jack Phillips told us about an interesting show being staged by No Way Gallery, which has no fixed physical space to speak of, we thought this might be a good time to ask whether bricks and mortar still matter in the gallery world. Cue Jack.
In the gallery. The No Way Project represents a roster of international and emerging artists who work outside the confines of a bricks and mortar gallery. With a focus on pop-up exhibits, No Way collaborate with institutions and independent practitioners in a bid to show lesser-known artists to the public. The project's founder, Charlotte Jensen, is constantly on the lookout for interesting spaces and like-minded individuals to prove that her ethos of fluidity and semi-permanence is an interesting one.
I think it suits artists, especially the kind of artists that we work with that are already not presenting work or exhibiting in conventional ways. It's more suitable for them rather than working with one space that ties them down geographically or ties them down even, you know, in terms of a location, in terms of the walls that they can present work in. In the beginning it was hard because you don't have a permanent venue, so it does take you longer to gain trust from people. Because how do they know it's not just going to disappear, or where you've come from, or what, you know, how you've got to where you are? But I have a lot of friends who have galleries or permanent spaces, and you know, they all love what they do. But I think it's such a ball ache to have somewhere that you need to finance constantly, and then automatically your position as a curator or as a gallerist or a dealer or whatever, collector, whatever you want to call it, changes because you have that pressure of doing something commercial all the time.
Currently on show at the Printhouse Gallery in London is a series of work by Japanese master of erotica, Toshio Saiki.
That all came about through a collaboration with Ghost Town. They were putting on a show in Tel Aviv of Saiki's work and asked us if we would like to do a show over here in London, and obviously said, hell yeah. So selling work, I think it doesn't really matter not having a permanent space. It's just about building your reputation. So it's quite a nice way of creating new audiences for places, you know, we leave some kind of legacy, I guess.
From pop-up shows to pop-up screens, online portals, galleries and auction houses are making it easier for people to see and buy artwork. But how receptive is the public to a pixelated viewing experience? Robert Norton is co-founder and chief executive of Sedition, an online gallery that distributes art in digital formats. Working with the likes of Damien Hirst, Doug Foster and Tracy Emming, among others, Sedition is also pushing the boundaries of the traditional gallery stereotype.
We provide opportunities for artists and collectors to engage in this new medium and to build collections of digital limited editions. These works start from less than $10 and go up to $1,000, and edition sizes vary from a couple of hundred to several thousand. We're seeing a growing collector base of people comfortable with the idea of owning and collecting art in digital format.
Each edition is signed, numbered, and authenticated by the artist, providing a marketable and saleable product. With a bespoke marketplace in the pipeline, Sedition collectors will be able to sell and trade their pieces. This means that the initial gallery model also becomes an auction house.
But more and more artists are considering digital tools and techniques, either in the process of their works which are designed for digital display, or just in the process of their works which then may then have a physical manifestation.
This platform has garnered industry interest and support, and although Robert admits that there is a touch of resilience from certain areas of the art sectors, big name players are becoming sedition collectors too.
In our first year, we did editions with the ICA for Barty Kerr, Steve Claydon, Mustafa Herlusi. We also did an edition with the Serpentine for Yoko Ono in her retrospective summer show last year. And I think that's a really exciting new development, which is that somebody can walk into one of the leading galleries or museums in their town, see a work that the artist has created specifically for a screen, and actually buy that same work that's shown on the same kind of screen in the museum and have it in their home straight away.
So what space does this leave for traditional bricks and mortar? The Listen Gallery in northwest London has been selling work since 1967. Founded by Nicholas Logsdale, it is globally recognised as a pioneer of the conceptual art movement. The likes of Anish Kapoor, Ai Weiwei, Tony Craig and Richard Deakin all exhibit in the vast space. In London, set over two locations, some 100 yards apart from each other, sales director Sam Chatterton-Dixon fully endorses their need for a physical space.
I think many of the artists we show often do want to work on a on a very substantial scale. So it's very important that we have a space that is able to show those kind of pieces at their best. We had a very large Anish Kapoor sculpture. Julian Opie did a very spectacular installation there. If we didn't have the space to do that, I think, you know, it would certainly hamper our commercial operation.
It seems important for a gallery that represents high-profile artists to have four walls that they can call their own. But given the option, would Listen pop up somewhere else?
We've been in this space for 40 years, and we like that sense of people knowing where we are. There's a sense of longevity. There's a lot to be said for having a permanent space where we know how the spaces work, as you say. We know the walls. We know how to hang pieces here. I mean, there is a lot to be said for having that status quo. For that reason, we have opened new spaces elsewhere. We've got a very beautiful space in Milan, in Italy, which we opened about a year and a half ago. And we have an office, the Bowery in New York, and that's a very interesting viewing space there. So we are also constantly moving and constantly looking for new opportunities as well.
A gallery's ultimate aim is to put up a great show, to place the artworks in a context that pleases the eye and empties the wallet. But whether the show is a pop-up, a selection of screens, or an established 40-year-old leased building, the show appeals to specific markets. Pop-ups give a platform to newer artists due to the small overheads. Institutions like The Listen provide a strong room for high-profile and currency-rich artists, while the online sector appeals to the tech-savvy investor and the everyman. Is the bricks and mortar gallery dead? Well, not for now. For Monocle, in London, I'm Jack Phillips. In the gallery.
Thanks, Jack, and that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, I'll be in LA, but fear not, lots of treats to come, including more of my adventure in Paris. And we'll rock up to Indie Lisboa to ask how Portuguese cinema is faring post-financial crisis. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was the wasted on the radio, Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher weaves her magic again to mix the show together. Time for one final song this week from her Midori House session. This is Casey Musgraves with Keep It To Yourself, something I don't recommend you do with this show. Thanks for tuning in.
You turn on the light, then you turn it back off, 'cause sleeping alone, yeah, it ain't what you thought. It's the drip of the sink, it's the click of the clock, and you're wondering if I'm sleeping. You heard from your friends that I'm doing okay, and you're thinking that maybe I made a mistake, and you want me to know, but I don't want to know how you're feeling. So keep it to yourself. If you think that you still love me, put it on a shelf. If you're looking for someone, make it someone else. When you're drunk and it's late and you're missing me like hell, keep it to yourself. See me out and I'm standing alone. Well, it don't mean that I'm gonna need a ride home. If you walk up to me like it ain't what it is, I know that it ain't gonna end with a kiss. So keep it to yourself. If you think that you still love me, put it on a shelf. If you're looking for someone